Do we have a new biomarker for Parkinson's disease?
Stents versus bypass surgery.
Can we avoid a sickle cell crisis?
And how effective are we at preventing blood clots in people with arthroscopic knee surgery or CAST?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on December 9th, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, we've got three from the New England Journal of Medicine this week and one from JAMA Neurology. That's the one I served up as, do we have a new marker for Parkinson's disease?
This was really fascinating, and I really wasn't aware that this was even in the works. Most of our listeners will know that Parkinson's disease is really highly prevalent, and unfortunately, currently it's an incurable neurodegenerative disease. It's associated with the accumulation of certain proteins inside the brain called alpha-synuclein. These proteins are in very small quantities. It's been difficult to detect them on a regular basis, and we've not had any way of using that to either detect Parkinson's before the symptoms develop or even using it to monitor disease process. Well, these investigators came up with a new way of detecting it. It's called protein misfolding cyclic amplification technology. Whoa, that's a big word. What happens is they use this particular protein as a seed to cause related proteins to misfold, and then they mix them up and use those as additional seeds to cause more proteins to misfold, so you can see how this amplifies. So they took a number of individuals with neurodegenerative disease, some of which had Parkinson's or Parkinson's-like disease, and other types of diseases, and they collected cerebral spinal fluid from them, and they used this particular assay, and it was 86% sensitive in detecting Parkinson's disease and 97% specific. That is, in people that didn't have Parkinson's but other neurodegenerative diseases, it wasn't present. So this is really a fascinating study and potentially very important finding.
I think it's really fascinating for a couple reasons. One, of course, is this intentional protein misfolding, which we're finding out that that is a putative issue in many diseases, not just in Parkinson's. So I think it's fascinating from that perspective. It reminds me of when PCR came over the threshold, and now, gosh, look at what we're doing with that. So that's a cool thing. I guess one question I have about this is, what's the utility of establishing a diagnosis of Parkinson's early, since we really don't have anything that's an effective intervention?
So that may be part of the issue. The disease has progressed so far along is the intervention may not be effective. So one of the things we may need to do is actually use treatments earlier in the disease process. The second is we might be able to use this to talk about disease progression and what the expectations are. Because as you know, some people progress very quickly, some not so quickly. And then lastly, we may be able to use this rather than clinical signs or symptoms to gauge whether therapy is effective or not. It needs to be tested in a larger sample of individuals because this study was done in a relatively small number of individuals, 76 with Parkinson's, 65 with other neurologic diseases. But again, I think it has a huge potential.
It'd be really great, and this is the last thing I'll say about this, if we could somehow find this particular misfolded protein in the blood rather than in the CSF, because there's not that many people who want to have a lumbar puncture for a diagnostic test.
I agree. And as you alluded to, the PCR, this was an initial test of amplified protein. Maybe we'll be able to detect this or some related protein in the blood in the future.
Excellent. Now let's go to the New England Journal of Medicine. We're going to stay there for the rest of the time. Something devoutly to be wished. Would it be possible to avoid a sickle cell crisis and all the attendant pain, sometimes hospitalization, in folks with that disease?
You know, in our 11-plus years of podcasting, we've never talked about sickle cell disease. On the one hand, this is novel to report on it. On the other hand, the reason why we haven't is because there hasn't been a lot of advancement in this particular disease process. People have sickle cell, have abnormal hemoglobin in their red blood cells, and it causes the red blood cells to be deformed and block up or occlude small blood vessels. And that leads to sickle cell crisis, a tremendous amount of pain, but not only pain, but significant morbidity and mortality as well. For the last 15 years, we've not had any new approaches to this. Well, one of the things that was discovered is that as a part of the sickle cell crisis or the occlusion, the blood cells actually stick to the inner parts of the blood vessels called the endothelium, and it causes them to clog up. What the authors noted was that there are antibodies we have to this particular protein. if we gave these antibodies to people with sickle cell, could we prevent some of that clogging of the blood vessels and prevent or delay the sickle cell crisis? So in this randomized trial, they took almost 200 patients that had a history of sickle cell crisis. Half of them received injections of this particular antibody about once every 3 weeks over the course of a year, and the other half received injections of placebo. Those that received this antibody to what's called P-selectin, that particular protein, had a marked reduction, a 45% lower rate of sickle cell crisis. They had a longer duration of time without the crisis, from about 1.4 months to 4 months, a longer time to when the second crisis would occur, and a significant, that is a 63% lower risk of having uncomplicated crisis as well. So this is for people with sickle cell that are bothered by a crisis, not only the pain, but the morbidity and mortality. This is a very important finding.
Excellent news. I am so happy to hear this, having seen people in crises and really seen how tremendously painful it is. Wow, I don't know what else to say about this, but I'm going to look forward to additional research on it. Maybe there are some other factors that can be identified that would reduce it even further.
Right, and again, and this is an injection, this is an antibody. It'd be nice if we could take an oral medication, but it carries potential application to thousands of people that suffer with this.
Very good. Now let's talk about, gosh, if you're going to undergo knee arthroscopy or casting, how can we avoid the formation of blood clots? Or can we?
Or should we? The reason why I bring that up is we know that if someone has had a hip replacement or a knee replacement, they're at a high risk immediately after surgery of having a clot in their leg, what's called deep vein thrombosis, that can predispose them to developing a clot in the lung, which is potentially serious. And so individuals with hip or knee replacement are typically put on some type of anticoagulant. The question is that really necessary for someone that doesn't have a knee replacement but just has arthroscopic surgery? And that's important because millions of individuals have that done each year. Approximately 4 million. Also, what about people that have had either ankle or lower extremity fractures and they're put into a cast? Do they need to be on blood thinners as well? There were two studies done with those two groups of individuals. And what they found is that in both those cases, the use of the blood thinner did not prevent symptomatic blood clots compared to placebo. And by the way, the incidence in both groups was very low, less than 1% with knee arthroscopy and less than 2% in individuals that had a cast on their lower leg.
Roar. You know how much I love these studies where we find out that there's something we can give a miss to.
Absolutely. And we know that putting thousands of people on blood thinners puts them at an increased risk of bleeding. So the nice thing is that for these individuals having knee arthroscopy or a cast in their lower leg, blood thinners aren't necessary.
Finally, let's go to our perennial favorite. Wow, you've got some clogs in one of the main arteries in your heart. Let's take a look at CABG or stents. And we're doing this so many times, I'm going to let you say what you found in this study.
All right, so when we talk about CABG, we're not talking about eating a vegetable. We're talking about coronary artery bypass grafting. We know that if you have a blockage in the left main artery and you treat those people medically, they don't do nearly as well as if they have bypass surgery. Well, those were studies that were done 40 and 50 years ago. Now we have stents. Can we avoid bypass surgery in these individuals and use a stent instead? To address that issue, over 1,900 individuals that had left main disease, a team of doctors looked at them and said, yes, this could be treated either with bypass surgery or likely successfully with stenting. So they were randomized to one of those two procedures and followed over the course of 3 years. And what they discovered is the composite endpoint of death, stroke, or heart attack was similar in those that received bypass surgery and in those that received stenting. Now, in the first 30 days, you were more likely to have a complication with bypass surgery, but over the next 3 years, you were more likely to have a complication with stenting.
Good deal less problematic, of course, to have a stent placed in general than to have CABG.
It is, but again, there are some trade-offs because with stenting, you're more likely to need a repeat procedure down the road. I think what this does is allows the patient to be involved in the decision-making process. All of these patients had a heart team. They had a surgeon, an interventional cardiologist, as I used to be, their primary care physician sitting down and explaining the options. Some people, believe it or not, would prefer bypass surgery, and as you suggest, some would prefer stenting.
I would add to that and just remind our listeners that just a few weeks ago, we reported on a new agent that may actually be able to reverse atherosclerotic plaques. And I'm thinking that, gosh, if you had a stent placed and you did very good medical therapy, plus potentially the addition of this agent, PCSK9, that we could end up with less invasive procedures and a better outcome.
Well, Elizabeth, in truth, you could make that same case for doing bypass surgery and then still giving another agent to regress.
Yes. And of course, I'm just being myself with my aversion to procedures, if at all possible. And then the less invasive, the better, as far as I'm concerned. On that note, I'm going to talk about the Parkinson's biomarker this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.